and welcome to the sixth GP Skeptics, a podcast by GPs for GPs, and where we tackle the weighty problems so familiar to GPs. I'm Dr. Justin Coleman, a Brisbane GP and born-again exerciser. And with me is Dr. Liz Sturgis, a Canberra GP, who has only been able to attend this podcast by sending her children for ice cream. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Justin. It's a bit unfortunate, isn't it?
Well, it's low-fat ice cream or...
Oh, maybe it's a lemon gelato or something. I don't know. Hopefully.
That sounds so yummy. It's got to be good for you. Tonight's podcast, we have an extraordinarily special guest, and it features none other than Dr. Liz Sturgis. Hi, Liz.
Oh, hi, Justin.
It's not because we couldn't get anyone who wanted to come on the podcast. We just thought that we'd do one on Liz's favourite topic. Now, Liz, for listeners who don't know, is doing a PhD on the GP's role in obesity management at ANU. And Liz is, in fact, heading off to Canada next year to Edmonton to do part of her PhD. And Liz, you mentioned it gets to minus 40 degrees in Edmonton. And I was wondering whether obesity might be a sort of a form of insulation which might save your life over there.
Oh, it could very well be. I'll let you know when I get back. But we won't be there for winter, thank goodness.
Okay. You might have to eat some more ice cream as preparation for Edmonton. So, Liz, tell me about the treatments for obesity, because as a GP, I'm often worried when people pop into my office and say, could you please prescribe this pill to make me thinner?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, Justin. Obesity drug treatments really have had quite a checkered past. And if we just run through the history, really, people have been using amphetamines back as early as the 1930s to try and help people with their weight. I was interested to read about rainbow pills, which were popular in the 40s, 50s and 60s. Now, this amazing pill was a combination of amphetamines, digoxin, diuretics and thyroid hormones. And unsurprisingly, a lot of people died or had heart attacks or strokes with those pills. So they were taken off the market.
Ooh, I couldn't think of a more appropriate way as a hippie to die than taking a rainbow pill in the 60s.
Very true. And then there was another amphetamine-like drug in Europe in the late 1960s, one called Aminorex, which is quite a cool name. But unfortunately, 50% of the people who took that drug developed chronic pulmonary hypertension, which is a condition that can lead to death.
So the pills seem to have a strong history of killing us as well as helping us lose weight.
Absolutely. And I guess closer to home and more recently, Reductyl was medication that was withdrawn from the Australian market after it showed increased heart attacks and strokes. And that one was a medication called sibutramine, which was a centrally acting SNRI related to amphetamine. So there's been quite a number of medications used for obesity over the years that have been withdrawn. Commonly, people are still being prescribed or using a medication called phentermine. Now, that one used to be available in combination with another medication called fenfluramine, but again, that medication was withdrawn in 1997 in Australia because it was causing people to get valvular heart disease, but phentermine on its own is still available. Although interesting, in a lot of countries around the world, it's only prescribed as a controlled substance. So therapeutic guidelines really say that one should only be used as a short one-off course. And common side effects include palpitations, headache and nausea. And rarely that one on its own can cause pulmonary hypertension and valvular disease.
Well, as our resident marketer, Liz, you would have been proud. I think the brand name for the phentermine and fenfluramine combo was Fenfen, one with an F and one with a PH. I thought that was kind of cute.
Fenfen, take your Fenfen pill. Unfortunately, it didn't do people much good. Mm. I had a look at the evidence for phentermine, which is still prescribed in Australia, and most of the clinical trials actually done back between 1975 to 1999, quite a while ago, and the most recent trial was from 2005, a Korean trial. And when I had a look at that one, it was a relatively short trial. They only looked at people over 14 weeks, and there was only 35 people in the phentermine arm and 35 people in the control arm. And they found at the 14-week mark, people who'd taken the medication had 7 kilos of weight loss, and people who hadn't had lost 2 kilos. So there was a significant difference, but of only 5 kilos between the two groups. And these were people that had an average BMI of around 29. And they did look at all of the biochemical markers that you would be interested in people who have obesity at 14 weeks, and none of them were different in any of the patients.
Because interestingly, I think it was last year, a fellow from America came out, a doctor doing the rounds of speaking tours, and was hugely pushing phentermine at, I think, high doses for lots of people and for very long term. And it caused a bit of an outcry amongst some of the GPs in the audience, who really felt that he was overstating the case given the lack of evidence for their long-term use. I think he was quoting his own patients, but they hadn't necessarily been written up as a peer-reviewed journal article. It was sort of more, this is what I do and it works.
Yeah, I have seen at a conference a clinical audit presented as though it was a randomized controlled trial. It's always kind of worrying when you see that happen, because we know that randomization of patients is so important to make both sets of your groups equal, and then you can compare them more equally. But yeah, it's not uncommon that clinical audits are presented in a way that overstates the differences between the groups. Something to watch out for when you're listening to conference presentations. In the US now, phentermine is actually used in combination with topiramate, so a reasonably old drug, topiramate, that seems to pop its head up every now and again for all different kinds of medical conditions. And interestingly, I thought you would find, Justin, that they're now marketing phentermine plus topiramate as one that you are on forever.
Right, and prescribe until death, so to speak, although perhaps they don't put that way in the marketing brochure, I would imagine, given the history of the early pills.
I don't think that's the tagline.
So Liz, there's always been a struggle as a GP to find a pill that's both safe and effective. Do you think we've found one yet?
I think obesity medications, people probably are expecting a bit more from them than what the trials show. Like if we look at that one of phentermine from Korea, it was a 5 kilo weight loss. So if people are looking for tens of kilos of weight loss, it's really probably not going to come from a pill. The pills are always used as well in combination with lifestyle. So you still need to eat well and do plenty of physical activity like you do yourself, Justin.
Exercise nut that I am. Look, thinking beyond the medications, Liz, I went to a presentation recently where we discussed whether obesity should be classified as a disease. And there were surprisingly disparate views from the audience of GPs. And it really was almost a 50-50 split between people who felt it was a disease and people who felt it was a marker.
Yeah. In terms of it being a disease, we definitely know people that have obesity for a significant period of time have completely different metabolic markers from people who've never had obesity. So if you look at people's leptin levels, and which make you feel full, and the ghrelin levels, which make you feel more hungry, they're completely different in people who have had obesity compared to those who've never had obesity. And unfortunately, looking at mice models, when they make the obese mouse slim again, the metabolic markers don't go back to what they were in the person who always had a regular weight, which really does point to that probably obesity is a disease process. But in and of itself, I guess what sometimes gets mixed up in that is that weight as a marker by itself is not the be-all and end-all. So we're really looking at weight and obesity as people's risk for chronic illness rather than just wanting them to lose weight for the sake of losing weight. And I think sometimes those two concepts get a little bit mixed up.
When we talk so much, as we all do, about exercise and diet, it's interesting, patients seem to me to concentrate very much in terms of those two outcomes leading to an improvement in weight. And sometimes I do try to steer them down the path of, look, you know, even if your weight stayed precisely the same and nothing changed, if you do increase your exercise and do improve your diet, you're going to be a whole lot healthier in lots of other ways, regardless of your weight change.
Absolutely right. I think we do place way too much emphasis on weight. There was a really interview that disturbed me quite a lot, actually. Do you know the actress Rebel Wilson?
So yes.
She's a comedy actress.
She's very funny.
She is. She's from Australia, and she's done incredibly well in the Hollywood market. And I would say a lot of her comedy really does draw on her body size and how she looks. So you'd think of anyone in the world that would be comfortable with how they look and their body shape and size, you'd think Rebel Wilson have to be her. And I heard an interview with her and Julia Zamaro, and Rebel was talking about how she got really, really sick once, and she got malaria and actually ended up in ICU, and she was incredibly unwell, like on death's door. And her comment was, "Well, I was really, really sick, but at least I was thin at that point."
To be fair on her, she is a comedian, Liz. I think that's quite funny, but I
Do you
can
think it?
understand if it was a seriously held view, I can understand it being a bit disturbing.
Yeah, I hope it was a joke because it really, I was quite like, what?
Sure.
You'd rather be sick in ICU than be overweight, which I guess as a medical community, we don't want to be part of any kind of message that's like that. We really do want to think about people's overall health rather than just being slim for the sake of it.
Oh, clearly.
Yeah.
It is a real issue for all GPs, I think, isn't it? And it comes up reasonably often in GP literature. How much do we raise weight? So there's that fine line between talking about something when it is going to improve someone's health and yet, making sure we don't make someone feel bad about it. So particularly, for example, the overweight teenager, particularly probably teenage girl, they have enough on their plate. And do you, as a doctor, then raise the issue? And if so, how do you raise it?
It's very, very complex. And I think, well, as doctors, you'd never want to diagnose or screen, I guess, someone for a condition if you don't have a good management plan to offer them at the end. So I think perhaps maybe our reluctance to bring up obesity as an issue with patients is that as a GP community, we probably feel like there's not a whole lot we can offer, that we've seen a whole lot of people try and get their weight lower and not being very successful. And we need to look at an entire culture shift around how we're approaching obesity, what we're expecting as outcomes, and how we discuss it with patients. There was a Lancet article recently from the UK where Paul Aveyard's a GP at Oxford who does a whole lot of behaviour change work. And what they did is they got the GP to just say to the patient, "It'll be helpful for your health if you reduced your weight. I'd really like you to go along to Weight Watchers. Here's a coupon to go to Weight Watchers." So in the UK, they're really trying to use GPs as a referral source to other management options like commercial weight loss. And they found in that study that patients were happy with that approach, and they didn't find it a problem for the GP to raise it in that way.
I think I wrote that article up actually as a news item, and in fact, the average weight gain for those offered the brochures was actually quite impressive compared to those who weren't offered the brochures, even though, in fact, both parties could attend the weight program if they wanted to. But I was quite impressed that even including those who were offered the brochures and didn't turn up, there was a substantial weight loss in the group that were offered them.
Yeah, if we think of our marketing and the first M, the messenger, I think GPs are really important messengers when people are thinking about their health and their lifestyle. And that probably might be a reflection of that, that the GP saying, "Hey, we need to talk about your weight and your lifestyle," makes people think about it more than perhaps if it comes from other messengers.
How important is it to avoid giving the message which reinforces the stigma?
I think it's super important, and there's lots of evidence in the literature that people who feel highly stigmatized around their weight tend to put on more weight over time. They find it much harder to lose weight, and they're much less likely to seek medical care. So I think it'd be really terrible if we had a situation where someone felt they couldn't approach a health professional or GP because of their weight and feeling that they'd be judged. I didn't really understand weight stigma until I started my PhD, and there are a number of people who helped me, I guess, understand it a bit better. One of the writers, she's actually a psychologist from America. Her name's Dr. Charlotte Cooper, and she describes herself as a fat activist, and she really looks at issues of weight stigma and issues within research itself that might be promoting stigma. I'm sure you've seen, Justin, the typical media image of a person with obesity with the bulging rolls, they might be eating a hamburger, and usually they don't have a head. Do you know the kind of image I'm talking about?
I've often wondered where their heads are.
Where are their heads? So Dr. Charlotte Cooper coined the term a headless fatty and has written a fantastic online description about how these media images make people with obesity feel. I might be incredibly naive, but did you know those headless fatty images, the person actually hasn't been asked their permission for it to be used on the news or whatever? I think because they've cut the person's head off, they then assume that person's anonymous.
Yeah, the Medical Writers Conference about 5 years ago, Katrina Bonfilioli, who's a lecturer in media studies at UTS, gave a talk on the headless fatties, I think following on from Charlotte Cooper's work. And she did open my eyes up to some of the issues there. The other thing I noticed, there's a website sprung up in the US, which is for photos of people who are overweight and obese, which are done with permission and done in context and good photos. So I thought that was a lovely outcome to spring from this.
Yeah, is that the World Obesity Image Gallery?
I'm not entirely sure.
No, it's really good. You can use those images completely for free, media or anybody, if you're doing a talk or whatever. But I think generally if you're at all portraying people with obesity, best to steer clear of that headless fatty image and call it out whenever you see it. Because I think I'd recognise myself without my head on. Would you recognise yourself, Justin?
It's the belly button ring that does it for me, Liz.
Do you have a belly button ring?
You've only met me a couple of times and I've never shown you my belly button. I don't, as it turns out, but I might have. That's the point. Or a definitive tattoo.
So I think, why don't we round off the conversation with a Christmas analogy, perhaps? If we think about Santa Claus and he's such a fat and jolly and happy man, does it really matter that he has obesity? If he's happy and healthy and able to do his work and it's fitting with what he wants, I'm not sure.
I think that is a wonderful last message, and I've always wondered how he fits down chimneys, but I guess there's that extra bit of magic there. To me, that was always more incredible than flying through the air with reindeer. In fact, talking of Father Christmas, we are hoping that our resident illustrator might actually do us a little a Christmas drawing. We're lucky enough to have Dr. Kat Ritchie, who has just been following GP Skeptics. I think she's our second fan. We had that medical student of yours earlier.
Registrar, he was a registrar.
Registrar, sorry. And then on Twitter, this person called Nico Richico, which turns out to be her pseudonym, started doing drawings, and I've stuck them up on the website. And so now I've contacted Kat and officially asked her to join the team. And we will put her illustrations up on the website. So thank you, Kat.
Thank you, Kat. They're fantastic.
Liz, you seem most interested in Kat because she posts amazing photos of her outfits.
I'm very impressed by her outfits. She has style. I'll just admire her from afar.
She has style, which brings style to the team for the first time, I would imagine, at the GP Skeptics.
No offence taken, Justin, at all.
Let's move on to the next segment, Liz's Marketing Magic.
Fantastic, Justin. So just to remind everyone, we're working our way through a framework called Mindspace, which is from the UK. Really great framework that looks at how people's behaviour is influenced. And we're applying this to looking at doctors' prescribing patterns. And today we're up to the P, which stands for priming.
Excellent. It was only last week I discovered that it was actually an acronym, Mindspace. I thought it was a frame of mind, but keep going. So P.
It was months we'd been talking about it. But anyway, so priming is where marketers use subconscious cues to try and influence your behavior and make you more open to their message. So I don't know if you finished your Christmas shopping, Justin.
Luckily, I'm married to someone who's finished her Christmas shopping. Yes.
You're very lucky. I went to the shops last week and I went in determined with my list just what I needed to buy. And I tell you, it was so difficult to not buy more and more and more. The music, the Christmas carols playing, all of the decorations everywhere, everyone looking happy. It really actually makes you want to buy a lot more things. But I was pretty good actually, because I recognized it. I was like, they are priming me to want to buy their stuff. It's quite
You
helpful.
won't fall for that sort of low
I will
primal.
not. And the other thing, another priming example would be when people are trying to sell their house. Apparently, if you bake something in your oven, so the smell of baking is through the house, people feel very homey there and like they might want to buy your house. And if we think about pharmaceutical reps, when they come to visit you in your practice, they often bring very nice food. They're often very nicely dressed. They speak to you very politely and smile at you. And they're often quite good looking, I would say. So all of those things prime your subconscious mind to think this is a good situation, a good person, and a message that I should be listening to.
That's great. I always thought that was called grooming, but now the more official word is priming.
I guess if you put a G in mind space, it becomes mind space, so it's not really helpful, is it?
Those darned acronyms, they get you every time. Thanks, Liz. That's great. All we need to know about priming.
So thanks, and now it's time for Justin's factoid. What have you got for us today, Justin?
I'm glad you asked that, Liz. My factoid from today was supplied to me by a medical journalist called Julie Lambert, who writes for the Medical Republic, and she interviewed me about this topic and wrote the article, which I'll also put up. It was a GP education provider called Reed Medical Education, and they run Think GP and that sort of thing. And they put up a prospectus on their website for 2017, but interestingly, it's not aimed at GPs. Or indeed, the groups which accredit their education for CME points, but it's aimed at the pharmaceutical sponsors who they're inviting to sponsor the education. There's nothing actively all that wrong with it, it's all the truth, but it's interesting seeing it from the marketer's perspective because they write in their prospectus whether you are looking for a brand exposure or change to prescribing behaviour, we offer market-leading online face-to-face access to over 50,000 GPs and health professionals in Australia. So they're basically pointing out to the farmer how much they can influence GPs. They go on to say, our in-house marketing team works tirelessly to market your education effectively and deliver your campaign goals and objectives. So not talking about necessarily what the GPs need to know in terms of education, but offering to farmer to set their own campaign goals and objectives for GPs. Prices start at $80,000 for a 6-hour online active learning module on ThinkGP, and a 1-hour education module is $35,000. They then point out that 50% of GPs don't see drug reps, which they say creates a huge barrier for those trying to change prescribing behaviour. It's interesting that in the no advertising campaign I ran a couple of years back, we spent all this effort trying to convince GPs not to see drug reps, and that's a growing number, partly as a response to that campaign, I suspect. But if you're not opening the front door, this is a way of perhaps getting in the back door for GPs. And they list two examples, Liz, and one was a program involving 1,000 GPs, which they measured and resulted in a behaviour change whereby, to quote the brochure, 60% of patients switched to combined hypertensives favourable to the client. In other words, they started prescribing the client's favoured brand. And then there was another one with 864 GPs. It boasts that the pharmaceutical client who sponsored that particular education program achieved a 15% increase in market share for an antidepressant. We're talking about common things like antidepressants and antihypertensives, where there are 50 drugs on the market, and it would be pretty hard to argue that if it was a reasoned, informed education, that any one particular one would be worth a 15% increase in market share or 60% of patients switching over to that. So I thought that was a very interesting insight into what happens behind the scenes when you're trying to market educating GPs.
Wow. Oh, interesting. What is one word for it? It's not uncommon these days, though, because we saw a similar thing with NPS, didn't we, recently, where they're at arm's length but accepting via different channels money from pharmaceutical companies for educational reasons. So it's becoming more and more common in the GP education space. I've had people say to me, well, Liz, how should it be funded then? how can we fund education for GPs if we don't go to pharmaceutical companies?
With the NPS ones, they have a separate arm called VentureWise instead of MedicineWise. I do think it's slightly different, although certainly I think they were mistaken to open that door. I do think it's still considerably more standoff and at arm's length than these other programs we're talking about. But nonetheless, I think it was a bit of a mistake and they should have a lot of caution in the future.
Can you think of other ways to fund GP education?
Well, I think peer-to-peer GP education is brilliant, and we do a lot of that on the whole FOMED and Foam for GP movements. There's also NPS therapeutic guidelines and bodies like that are, if not entirely independent, then at least certainly relatively independent, and I think they offer fantastic education opportunities. And I'm employed to write medical education by various groups. That might be the asthma group or diabetes group or heart group. And I'm an independent medical writer. It's done fairly cheaply, and I think that's an excellent way of getting education. So I don't think it does have to be this big ticket item grant. It went up to $110,000 in this sort of thing.
Wow.
No one can really pay for that except huge pharmaceutical companies, and realistically they're only going to pay for that if they feel that the net value to them is going to be a lot more than $110,000 worth of extra money from their scripts, which they wouldn't have got otherwise if people hadn't attended the education. So to do that, you've got to write out perhaps $1 million worth of extra script if the profit is going to be an extra 100 grand for the company.
I see. So I was once invited to write an education online module for GPs. It was a reputable company, and it wasn't till I was all the way nearly through it that I realized it was being funded by a pharmaceutical company, sort of at arm's length. But I had to work really hard as the independent writer to keep the cases and the way it was presented in an independent fashion that I was happy with.
Yes, that certainly does happen. It's shades of grey. It's all a spectrum, I guess. Ideally, you would have independent education, which is entirely evidence-based. That's not going to always happen. The more gap between the content producer and the sponsor, the better in terms of the independence. And there's various models and ways of doing it.
Yeah, and if education is driven by patient needs and health outcomes rather than what is the latest and greatest medicine on the shelf.
Exactly. If you're designing education to purely be for patient benefit, then I think you need a whole bunch of barriers and separations from sponsors in place to get that quality in the content.
I feel like we need to lift the mood a little, Justin. So let's go straight on to what would Justin do?
Liz, I hope you have a Christmassy theme for me.
I do, Justin. I have a fairly light one for you today. Just, I guess, to be a little bit silly, magical time of year that Christmas is. Justin, if you could have a magical superpower, anything in the whole world, what would it be? I know you're already a GP, so that's pretty magical and super.
Liz, I thought you were going to introduce this with a Santa toy saying ho, ho, ho or something. Do you realise you're letting listeners down? I think this is our first podcast without a Liz toy.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I think it's in the garage in a box. We do have one of those awful Santas that plays a little drum and has music, and I'm hoping the kids won't find it actually this year.
Liz, my superpower, I think, would be flight.
No, I wanted a medical superpower.
Oh, geez.
Sorry to be strict on this.
Well, if flying isn't good enough for you, Liz, I think my medical one would be the power of persuasion.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, we all want it. So, look, some people have it. You see some doctors, honestly, and I don't know if they look into your eyes and they just seem to have the personality for it. You know, I'm okay in a debate or something like that, but sometimes that's not what patients need. I'm thinking lifestyle changes here. So if you can look into someone's eyes or however it works, perhaps there's some sort of wand involved, I'm not sure, and convince that person, look, here is a way out of your current predicament, and that person would be able to change their mind magically.
I like it. I think you'd need a wand for that for sure.
Well, I would. You know those brief GP interventions? Part of the magic thing is it has to only take 2 minutes. So I have to be able to persuade these people to change their, you know, diet and exercise in just a 2 minute period. I want a number needed to treat of one. That's what I want.
Fantastic.
I suggest you quit smoking. One. And they quit smoking. 100%.
Yes, Dr. Coleman, I will quit smoking.
I'd also take that superpower home to my family, which would be very handy as well. But I think it's been a wonderfully entertaining Christmas topic of obesity, Liz. And I wish our listeners, I'm assuming it's in the plural these days.
There's at least three.
All the best for the festive season. And Liz, it's been a fantastic start to GP Skeptics this year. We just decided to do and we went ahead and did it. And I look forward to many more. We've already got a few interviewees lined up for 2017, I believe.
Can't wait. Have a lovely Christmas, Justin. And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.